In the annals of time, riding social forces as they crest and crash under the shores of history, some would-be heroes stumble but manage to recover their breath. Others are reduced to the flotsam and jetsam of nostalgia. These others are our subjects. They are the vanquished.
November 4th, 2008, John Sidney McCain III stepped up onto a stage at the Biltmore Hotel in Phoenix, Arizona. Before a crowd of supporters, McCain announced, "A little while ago, I had the honor of calling Senator Barack Obama." Before he could finish, McCain was interrupted by a chorus of boos. The next day, McCain rolled out of bed in his Phoenix condo. For the first time in several months, he was without Secret Service detail. John McCain walked down the street to Starbucks. Alone. Welcome to The Vanquished. Anders J. Lee here. On this installment, we are talking about an infamous presidential runner-up, really the world over, one John Sidney McCain III, whose life spanned a good chunk of the 20th century and played a significant role in the 21st as well. Now, there's a lot of ground to cover here on the topic of John McCain. He's around for a lot of stuff. But in particular, I wanted to get a good sense of what he meant to American culture in the 1960s, him and other POWs like him. And to do that, I have a great guest. But first, let's get a little rundown of John McCain's presidential campaigns. McCain entered the 2000 Republican primaries as a media favorite. He even referred to political journalists as his base. The moderate Arizona senator became infamous for his Straight Talk Express bus, where reporters could ask him anything for hours on end, captured by David Foster Wallace in his piece, Up Simba. McCain was also infamous for his town hall meetings, where participants could ask him any question they wished. This led to off-the-cuff, perhaps poorly aged moments, like this one with an African-American high school student.
It's not necessary to do that. Thank you for your question. May I ask if you're on the basketball team?
No, no.
May I ask? I think you should be. Thank you, sir.
We all remember the gridlock between the Democratic president and the Republican Congress. As a Republican yourself, you think you'd be...
Despite the warm coverage, George W. Bush was the party's favorite son and had a near monopoly on evangelical primary voters. His nomination felt like a foregone conclusion. So it was a shock to the political world when McCain won the New Hampshire primary with a whopping 49% to Bush's 30. The focus turned to South Carolina, where it was widely accepted the Republican nomination would be decided. The state was blanketed in negative ads for the Bush campaign and salacious accusations from the far-right rumor mill. McCain countered with an attack of his own, comparing his opponent to Bill Clinton, something that junior George Bush took great umbrage to. But it wasn't enough. Upon losing South Carolina to Bush by nearly 9 points, McCain decried scions of the Christian right, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, as agents of intolerance. Though South Carolina is remembered as the last stand of McCain's 2000 campaign, he went on to win the Michigan and Arizona primaries a mere 3 days later. On Super Tuesday, McCain won every remaining state in New England other than Maine and lost everywhere else. On March 9, 2000, John McCain bitterly withdrew from the Republican primary and took 2 whole months to endorse Bush in a press conference featuring this infamous moment.
Senator, why do you have difficulty using the word endorsement when you talk about your support for Governor Bush?
I endorse Governor Bush. I endorse Governor Bush.
By the way, I enthusiastically accept.
Does that have to do with the feelings you still have about the kind of primary that you...
From the day he dropped out, McCain knew that he would run again. even perhaps if it meant challenging his party's sitting president for the Republican nomination. Prospect he wasn't exactly shy about. Here he is on The Daily Show in July of 2001.
Senator, what, can we count on you sure. to maybe run again in 2004? I think that would electrify the country, and we would certainly enjoy the process of it. Can we count on you?
Somebody said that if you're a United States senator, unless you're under indictment or detoxification, you automatically consider yourself a candidate for president of the United States. And my old friend Mo Udall said that presidential ambition is a disease which can only be cured by embalming fluid. So I think both of those are fairly true adages. For,
well, we're excited that you won't be embalmed and you will be running, and we look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks very much for coming by.
And visit your money, will you?
I'd love to. Yeah.
According to an anonymous friend in Rolling Stone, McCain was gearing up to run a 2004 rematch based on ethics, campaign finance, and Enron, the corrupt relationship between Bush's team and the corporate sector. But 9/11 changed everything. True to the legacy of his hero, Theodore Roosevelt, the John McCain of the early 2000s matched his anti-corruption domestic politics with a jingoistic view of the world stage. On September 12, 2001, he told David Letterman that it wasn't just al-Qaeda who was bent on destruction of the United States, but Syria, Iraq, Iran, perhaps North Korea, Libya, and others. A month later on the same show, he said this.
How are things going in Afghanistan now?
I think we're doing fine. I think we'll do fine. The second phase, if I could just make it very quickly, the second phase is Iraq. There is some indication, and I don't have the conclusions, but some of this anthrax may, and I emphasize may, have come from Iraq.
Oh, is that right?
If that may be the case, then that's when some tough decisions are going to have to be made.
It was perhaps because he came in second to Bush in 2000 that McCain was not quite the frontrunner for the Republican nomination going into 2008. Championing an unpopular war after having distanced himself from the party's evangelical base left McCain with a fledgling, underfunded, and unpopular campaign throughout 2007. But after tying Fred Thompson for third at 13% in the Iowa caucus, McCain went on to win a strong first-place showing in New Hampshire for the second time with 37%.
My friends, you know, I'm past the age when I can claim the noun kid, no matter what adjective precedes it. But tonight, we sure showed them what a comeback looks like.
McCain had spent the past 4 years or so trying to make peace with the hard right, and not just tone, but substance. Leading up to and during the 08 primaries, McCain reversed a bevy of positions, including, as reporter Tim Dickinson detailed, the Bush tax cuts, the estate tax, waterboarding, hunting down terrorists in Pakistan, kicking Russians out of the G8, a surge of troops into Afghanistan, the GI Bill, storing nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain, teaching intelligent design, fully funding No Child Left Behind, offshore drilling, his own immigration policy, and withdrawal timelines for Iraq. Even so, McCain would have to return to haunted ground and win South Carolina in order to secure the nomination. The weeks leading up to the South Carolina primary, McCain was behind or tied with Southern Governor Mike Huckabee, who spoke the language of Christian fundamentalism. But on primary day, McCain was able to turn out members of the military, many of whom still viewed him as a legend for his POW days, and squeak past Huckabee by 3%. McCain was now the de facto nominee. Going into the fall campaign, McCain was competitive in polling with Obama with at least one underlying problem. In July, campaign advisor Phil Graham dismissed Americans' economic woes by saying the country was merely in a, quote, mental recession, unquote, and went on to call the U.S. a, quote, nation of whiners. Graham was quickly jettisoned from the campaign, McCain joking that he would be considered for ambassador to Belarus. Meanwhile, the candidate's once infamous relationship with the press was breaking, exemplified by this excruciatingly awkward interview with Time magazine. Time. There's a theme that recurs in your books and your speeches, both about putting country first, but also about honor. I wonder if you could define honor for us. McCain. Read it in my books. Time. I've read your books. McCain. No, I'm not going to define it. Time. Do you miss the old way of doing it? McCain. I don't know what you're talking about. Time. Really? Come on, Senator. McCain. I'll provide as much access as possible. Time. In 2000, after the primaries, you went back to South Carolina to talk about what you felt was a mistake you had made on the Confederate flag. Is there anything so far in this campaign that you wish you could take back or you might revisit when it's over? McCain does not answer. Time. Do I know you? Laughs. Long pause. McCain. I'm very happy with the way our campaign has been conducted, and I am very pleased and humbled to have the nomination of the Republican Party. Time. You do acknowledge there was a change in the campaign and the way you had run the campaign. McCain shakes his head. Time. A lot of people know about your service from your books, but most people don't know that you have two sons currently in the military. Can you describe what it means to have Jack and Jimmy in uniform? McCain. We don't discuss our sons.
Now, to get a better sense of John McCain's meaning in American culture, what he meant historically, and how the Vietnam era launched a career like his, I had the privilege of speaking with a historian of the Vietnam era and American culture, one David Parsons. Let's go to that interview. Well, David Parsons, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Of course. How are you?
I'm doing well. Wanted to talk to you about John McCain.
Mm.
You have some expertise in at least one area of his life. But why don't we start? What was your first exposure memory of John McCain, the Maverick?
That's a good question. It must have been, honestly, at some point in the late 90s. Or maybe even the 2000 presidential campaign. It's funny that we're sitting here. I know we're going to talk about failed presidential campaigns, and I think that's what brought him to my attention, because I was a young guy in the 90s and a very casual watcher of American politics. But it feels like I don't know. I'm glad to talk about McCain's presidential campaigns, in part because they're the defining sort of place where I got to know him. So I think it's really probably the 2000 presidential campaign that I really knew who he was.
Yeah, same. I mean, I was very young at the time also, but I just remember, you know, my mom is not a registered Democrat, but a loyal Democratic voter. And I remember her saying during those primaries, like, this McCain guy, he's a Republican, but I could actually see myself voting for him, which was for a while in the 2000s. Anyway, before 2008, it was like, this guy is the favorite Republican of Democrats in America. The kinder, gentler.
That might explain in part why I wasn't exposed to McCain or he wasn't on my radar, in part because, and I've talked about this on my own podcast, but like the idea that in the 90s, the sort of cool, hip, right-wing conservative thing that was happening was like Rush Limbaugh. And it's weird to think now in terms of the politics of the Republican Party, because it's similar, but it's gone so much further right. But there was a contest in the 90s, too, for like, how outrageous can we be? There's a culture war going on. And I feel like McCain's name didn't come up in there, in part because he was a moderate. He was someone who was sort of like not really a culture warrior in that same way. And as a result, didn't get as much press, I don't think, as other figures who were saying the nasty stuff, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Yeah, because I forget who put it this way, but it makes a lot of sense about McCain, is that he missed the 60s in America. He was literally in prison for it. So he missed the culture wars of, you know, hippies, hard hat, right? He didn't have a Wi-Fi at the time and is in the Hanoi Hilton.
Right.
So he was kind of a classic Republican who, you know, was making overtures to Teddy Roosevelt, but at the same time was a war hero. So nobody could really question his hardcore foreign policy bona fides.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the 60s and Vietnam, I'm curious. So he gets, and you're a historian, you've written about the Vietnam War and the resistance to it in the United States. Early in the conflict, when he's deployed, I believe 65, what is the perception in the United States of the war in Vietnam at that time, in the mid-60s?
It's the summer of 1965 when American ground troops first are literally invading Vietnam. And so that's really the moment. And I've talked to my parents about this a lot because they're of that prime generation. They're like the Ken Burns, they're the right, like Forrest Gump age to remember all of this stuff and not only remember it, but tell me about it all the time throughout my youth. And I still talk to my dad a lot about this era. But what he impresses upon me a lot is like the early 60s were kind of like the late 50s in terms of political awareness among young people, certainly ones that weren't on college campuses. And so 1965 is the moment where it feels like the Vietnam War is a national, comes to national awareness as an actual war. It's funny for me to say that because the war had been going on for a long time. And the United States involvement had been going on. Honestly, since the 1940s, the United States had been involved in what was called French Indochina. But either way, 1965 is the moment where it really explodes into the national consciousness as like, we're going to war. American troops are going there. There's a ground invasion, and that there's going to be a draft that's going to bring, it's going to essentially force young people to make a decision about what they're going to do here. And all of that, I think, comes as a shock to a lot of Americans, maybe the ordinary American who wasn't really following it closely in 65.
Right. Because I know I've heard Noam Chomsky talk about the early 60s and how he would give lectures about Vietnam, but it would be to like one person in their living room. And it was like really hard to get before any kind of mass audience and tell them about what was happening. And of course, before the internet or anything like that.
Yeah, it would have been on the back pages. And I mean, it would have been, and that's almost explains in part why the Johnson administration is going to amplify the Gulf of Tonkin incident. They feel like they need to amplify it. They need to make something bigger out of it because it's not in the public consciousness in the way that it is now. And it is certainly in 1966, 67, in the years that you're talking about, McCain being in Vietnam and then imprisoned in Vietnam until 73.
Gulf of Tonkin, I mean, that's something we should explore a little bit because that's something I grew up hearing about. Gulf of Tonkin, it's like this is like a false flag thing because you hear about it in retrospect. But at the time, what was that? What was reported? What was the Senate told? And what actually transpired, if anything, in reality?
Well, I mean, it's a huge story. I mean, there's like the best treatment I've seen of it, honestly, has been in the movie The Fog of War, which is about Robert McNamara, because he gets into the sort of slippery facts of what happened there. I think it's easy to fall into a kind of, especially as a left wing person, it's very easy to fall into like a kind of conspiracy theory about like, oh, they just made this up. I mean, the reality is there was gunfire probably exchanged between these boats. But the United States also misread what was happening as a larger event than what they thought it was. And they were obviously the forces that were within Johnson's administration that were pushing for a more aggressive military engagement in Vietnam. They saw this as a way to justify the war. And that's what led them to write the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and push it through Congress, and not only push it through Congress, but Johnson himself is going to engage his very famous powers of persuasion and really get in people's faces. I mean, he often physically gets in people's faces and gets the votes for this resolution that more or less gives Johnson a blank check to wage a more open war in Vietnam, which is something that, I mean, I think it's important to understand that like the administration itself, there are divided voices there. It's the hawks that win in this moment, but there are a lot of voices, including McNamara, who's sort of like a little on the fence about whether he wants to support a ground invasion, because most of them see that as pretty insane. And so the Gulf of Tonkin thing, you know, to make a long story short, is an event, a small skirmish. It's important to note that the United States has like militarized boats in this water, so they're being shot at defensively. Either way, that skirmish is turned into an excuse for a larger invasion.
Right. And I have to ask, slightly off topic, but now, you know, this is a debate that continues today about JFK, what his executive orders actually implied in regards to Vietnam. Do you buy the theory that he wanted to pull U.S. troops and involvement out of Vietnam, or do you think it would have been roughly the same as LBJ?
When I watch the Oliver Stone movie, JFK, I'm totally convinced. I'm like, man, they iced this dude because he was going to create peace in Vietnam. I don't know. I had one of the like top scholars of this whole moment is a historian named Frederick Logevall. I remember talking with him on my podcast a long, long time ago. And I asked him like this exact question, and he kind of led me through the idea that, you know, JFK had a pretty hard line against the idea of a ground invasion. And that he thinks if he's like, I hate it. He's an academic. So he's like, I hate answering this question. I don't like to like project, you know, what may have happened, what would have happened if Lincoln wouldn't have been killed, all that sort of thing. But either way, he's like, I don't know. It feels like the figures that got Johnson's ears, the hawks within the administration, that cancer within the administration that wanted to go to war in a real hawkish, aggressive, nasty way, they didn't have JFK's ear in the same way that they're going to have LBJ's, for like all sorts of reasons, personal, political, social, et cetera. And so he convinced me that, yeah, JFK may not have pursued war in the same way that Johnson did. And that's, I mean, the ground invasion is so profound, a change in what happens, that it's a hard thing to think about, honestly.
And McCain in 65, he demands a combat assignment. He wants to see action. He's part of a military family, served in, you know, both world wars, his father and grandfather. And then he complains. And especially later, after he comes back to the U.S. and is studying the war, he's really adamant that the bigwigs in the U.S. military didn't know what they were doing. And there was this disconnect between the rank and file of the military, including pilots, and the civilian commanders, who he called complete idiots. What do you make of that? Is he correct about that? Was there a smarter way to pursue the Vietnam War?
Oh God. I mean, that to me, this is the root of such a deep, like hard discussion about, because it filters into the politics after the war of like, oh, did we do enough? Could we have done enough? Was it those nerd bureaucrats in Washington who were restraining the military from doing what they absolutely needed to do to win the war? And sort of like, well, I mean, we dropped more bombs on Vietnam than every force in World War II combined. So I'm not sure how much more force we could have applied to these people to get our way there. And there's kind of a sadistic edge to that. But in terms of the actual sort of way the war is prosecuted. Yeah. I mean, that's the feeling. I mean, I mentioned Robert McNamara. McNamara is emblematic of exactly that type of operation of the war, a kind of scientific war, that is going to be waged instead of through militaristic principles, but through the strategies employed by the new data industries and, corporate management. And McNamara comes from Ford Motor Company, and he's going to apply the same rational sort of math-like, data-driven approach to the war as he applies to creating cars and factories. And that's what McCain and others in the military are reacting to. They're like, why are we being restrained, or why is the war being defined in these corporate scientific terms? Why can't we just bomb who we want to bomb? To me, it's really key piece of McCain, because he sort of like always seems like he wants to go harder into like the hard right, aggressive, violent, sort of primeval right wing. But then the other part of him feels like he's not really with those hard right barbarians. And that dance that he wants to play, I guess it's effective for him. I mean, we could talk about that, but it feels like he's caught in the middle between the sort of liberals who are running the war in Vietnam, out of Washington in a very bureaucratic, so-called smart way, and the military, who have their own way of running the war and want to be unleashed in a different way.
Right. He kind of ends up being simpatico with many neo people who go on to become neoconservatives who start out as radicals in the 60s. And then they come over to the idea, you know, the communism is bunk ideology. It's a failed project. And we just got to take out these dictators like Saddam Hussein in pursuit of liberal values, liberal ideas like free speech and whatnot. And I think McCain, even though he was on the opposing side of them during the Vietnam War, is very much in that sort of mindset of like, we have to protect freedom around the world. And you see that in his overtures towards the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. I remember the last survivor of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade who fought the fascists in Spain. He wrote an obituary for it. It's kind of bizarre to have a Republican senator, you know, eulogizing a communist militant who literally fought in the name of communism in the 30s.
But I think you're absolutely right, though, about McCain being like, I mean, he's kind of a liberal. And it seems as we go further into whatever we're politics are like post Trump or Trump, whatever, it feels like he, in hindsight, he's more of a liberal to me. Or he seems like that, at least in terms of the foreign policy stuff you're describing, which is sort of buying the notion that American forces are and the military is to be used to sort of create the atmosphere for freedom and liberty around the world. I mean, it's easy to get into that sort of language with him because that's what he believed, it seems like.
Well, at the time he shot down 1967, he had been, well, he had kind of been a public figure before that because he was on Jeopardy for one day and won that. But he is, do you know when he got shot down? Is that a big media story? Does he become like an icon overnight just from getting shot down, or does it take a while?
Yeah, no, I think it's not necessarily the shot down part of it, but the POW part of it is in the New York Times and the Washington Post on the front page. And this is in, I think, 67. I think it's October 67, which is really interesting because that's around the same time that the Pentagon March happens, where these like all these hippies surround the Pentagon and Allen Ginsberg is there and all these psychedelic people are trying to like levitate the Pentagon. But then there's also a faction of hard leftists, I guess, anti-war people who are there to fight the cops at the Pentagon. It turns into like one of the signal moments of the 1960s. Norman Mailer wrote a book about it called Armies of the Night, which is a really famous rendering of all that stuff. Anyway, that's happening at the same time McCain is being shot down in North Vietnam and captured and going through, I mean, honestly, an insane experience. And that, to me, that experience, those, what, 6 years that he was in Vietnam as a captive, that's defines his political career so much and gives him, like, I don't know, almost like, it's almost like that experience is like a political shield for him for the rest of his life, because he went through that. He's sort of owed a political career, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
A lot of people feel that way. I mean, they must.
Yeah. Well, can you speak to the way he and the other POWs were kind of instrumentalized by the U.S. government to support the war?
Yeah. That's through the Nixon administration that gets involved with POWs heavily as a sort of cover for what they're doing. And I mean, cover, that sounds conspiratorial, although Nixon, with him, it's easy to go there. But yeah, I mean, it's PR, it's optics. What the Nixon administration is doing with POWs is parading around their rescue and sort of using them to make exactly the kind of point we're talking about with unleashing the military and sort of putting a positive spin on what's going on in the war. But there's a deep split within that POW community. It's something that is not and they're not a monolithic group, and they don't have all Republican Party politics. So McCain was sort of in there with the Nixon administration, although, you know, he's going to be one of the POWs that's used by the Nixon administration as a sort of symbol of them being the good guys and them bringing a sort of dignified end to the war. At the same time, I think McCain you know, he's going to, in his political career, separate himself a little bit from the Nixonian sort of politics. And that's going to be a big part of his career, I think, is not necessarily conscious separation from Nixon, but a conscious separation from a sort of atmosphere of corruption that hangs over the Republican Party, which is sort of ironic considering his involvement in later scandals, which I guess we'll get to.
Well, he's in the prison camp during the 1968 election when Nixon is finally elected president, and he defeats Hubert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, former senator from Minnesota. What can you tell us about Humphrey's trajectory, what he represented in American politics, and was there a different course between him and Johnson?
That's a great question. Humphrey's an interesting figure, but I think he's someone a little bit like McCain. And what I mean by that is he's someone who's going to try to play the middle, and try to do exactly like what I think we started with, which was, wow, McCain is the Republican that like my Democrat aunt will vote for because he represents certain values that she's about. I think that Humphrey was sort of trying to be that figure, but he was also hobbled by the fact that he was Lyndon Johnson's vice president, and it was difficult for him literally to separate himself from the policy. And there were a couple moments where I think Humphrey made some speeches that were considered anti-war. He's going to get like phone calls from Johnson himself. That are going to sort of chastise him for making him look bad, essentially. So Humphrey's in a difficult position in terms of trying to win over any electorate with a clear message, because he's anti-war, he's for the war, I'm going to win peace. And someone like Nixon, who it's weird because he's an unlikely political figure in some respects at this point. He's someone from the past. He's someone from the Eisenhower administration. But Nixon just runs right over Humphrey. And I mean, it's the same in the next election, right? I mean, Nixon is going to win just incredible majorities, electoral majorities. And these figures that are sort of the wishy-washy take or considered that way by the American electorate are just going nowhere during a time where you need a more, it's kind of like now you need a more extreme or decisive take. And Nixon provided that, I think, in a way that Humphrey could not.
Yeah, that's right. I learned just recently, Humphrey ran in 72. I didn't know that. And he almost defeated McGovern for the nomination. But his campaign was just kind of like, hey, remember me? This is what
you're
going to have.
There's a quiet tragedy to these guys a little bit. I feel like McCain was like that a little bit at some point later in his career. Remember me and I'm still the Maverick.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, God.
But as our producer Jules points out, McCain was in the Naval Academy, graduated fifth from last. And that's, yeah, something else I remember from the 08 campaign is learning he was a bad boy as a young man. he was kind of, I mean, it was since the 50s. So he was, you know, wearing the leather jackets, doing kind of the James Dean thing, and kind of tumbled into being a combat pilot and did want to see combat. Some have suggested, I'm not an expert in aeronautics, but that perhaps him getting shot down may have something to do with his own pilot skills.
That's a low blow, man.
that's just what other people have said. I don't know. I couldn't fly a plane for the life of me. So
I know they had to go lower on this particular mission. I know that they didn't want to go on this mission necessarily. They were shooting at they're trying to bomb a power plant in North Vietnam. And I think there was an anxiety about the mission, and most of the other planes got shot down on the mission, and the power plant was not destroyed. So it was a total failure. I have no idea if McCain's skills behind the sticks had anything to do with the crash, though. But yeah, he got shot by Soviet weaponry, actually, by the North Vietnamese.
Really?
Yep.
And did they get that during the war? Or?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they had a mishmash of weapons that they took from that they got in from countries like Soviet Union, China, But a lot of, I mean, to me, the most interesting stuff is the weaponry that they took from the French that were already dug in there, because the French fight a war with them and then leave, and the French leave behind all of this, you know, World War II era anti-aircraft weaponry that they essentially, you know, smuggle into the jungle and are going to use in the efforts against the next enemy, which is the United States.
Yeah, the whole war is just so, growing up, you know, mostly in the 21st century, kind of bizarre in retrospect to think that, you know, France was fighting this country. They occupied them. They're a colony. They give up. And then for some reason, it becomes the United States' job to fight and, you know, stop these people from running their own society. It's just kind
of. Yeah. And it's more, it's honestly more like the French are in control, but then World War II happens and they're not able to really keep control, especially of a rising sort of, you know, democratic indigenous movement from below. They're not able to control that. And the United States is sweating it out. The United States is like, are you guys going to be able to do this? Do you need more weapons? They keep giving like the French more weapons. At some point, the United States offers the French government nuclear bombs and says, do you need nuclear bombs to drop on Vietnam? Because we don't want this going to the communists, because domino theory, blah, blah, blah. We'll lose access to the whole area, et cetera. So we're like sort of like secretly like helping the French for years and years and years and years. And the French fucking lose in 1954. And the United States is sort of like sweating again. Are we going to do anything about this? And that leads us into the JFK era that we're talking about, where JFK sort of like, it gets to the point where we may have to send ground troops here, which is just, I mean, insane to most even military strategists, but did it anyway and killed Vietnamese people for the next 12 years after that. So, I mean, it's a gruesome story, and the politics of it are pretty bitter too. But they're also, I don't know, they're sort of, they're hallmarks of the 20th century in a lot of ways, in the sort of anti-colonial project and what kind of weird politics that produced.
Yeah, because, you know, I remember as a kid growing up in the 90s, looking back, like Vietnam was kind of ubiquitous still at that point culturally. People were always talking about Vietnam. There was just seemed like a lot of movies, and it was all the adults in my life. It seemed like that's all they could talk
about. It's not anymore, right? It feels weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was this whole movement. I mean, one of my first memories is seeing these signs in the early 90s, POWMIA, and I was learning to read at the time. I was like, what does POW MIA mean? And then years later, I learned it's this big conspiracy theory that all these POWs that, you know, ostensibly were detained in the same place as McCain was, were kept in these underground tunnels and all this stuff. What was it about the war that created that kind of delusion in the American psyche?
Oh, that's a great question. Because I think of it, yeah, as a delusion, or I often think of it as like a haunting that, you know, and maybe that's from seeing it like you did, like being a young person in the 80s and 90s and seeing the Vietnam War as this sort of like, you're picking up little pieces of it. And it seems like it's something that people are mad about, maybe, and they thought about. But there's also like, I remember that POW MIA flag, and I remember seeing that. And I remember my dad taking me to a Vietnam War memorial. It was like a replica of the wall, the Vietnam War mall wall that has like all the names of the people that died in the war, at least the American names. That came to my town when I was like a little kid. I was like 8 years old or something. And I went to it, and I didn't really understand much of it, but I remember seeing like groups of veterans hanging out there, like in wheelchairs, many of them. They had big beards and long hair, and they were sort of like that image of that like fucked up American veteran, Vietnam veteran. And that stuff stuck with me. And then, of course, watching movies like Platoon and things like that, eventually I understand it's something more, but there was something eerie about it. There's something, yeah, like it was like understanding almost on a subconscious level that there was something bad happened in the past, and it had to do with this thing called Vietnam, and people were mad about it. And my dad didn't really want to talk about it, even though my dad didn't go to Vietnam. He was in the U.S. Marines at the time, and almost went to Vietnam. And I think the almost went to Vietnam part of it sticks with him in a very particular way. And so that was in the conversation in my house growing up, was what Vietnam was, who went, who didn't, what it meant. And I think you're right. I mean, it's dropped off a little bit, but maybe dropped off a lot as that population gets older. But I think that part of it has to do with the fact that the war split people up, made people very, very angry on one side or the other of like their extreme politics. The counterculture and drug element, I think, is really poppy in a way, and partly explains why the movies were so compelling, was that like this was a war, not like World War II, where the guys were all these like clean cut depression era farm boys, but instead the World War or the Vietnam movies are like all these like fucked up 60s dudes, and like a lot of them are like far out and on drugs, and there's like fast talking black guys that are fighting the war, and all of that together made for a much more kind of pop culture vision of Vietnam and war than previous wars, if that makes sense. And I think that that stuff stuck with us in a way that is probably different than other periods in American life, because it was tied up with all that counterculture. I still think Forrest Gump is like the delivery system for most of this, for a whole generation of people. I mean, I think at a certain point in like the 90s or 2000s, Forrest Gump was on TV like every day. I feel like it was like there was like a Gump channel or something, and it just delivered this very specific story. Yeah.
I remember every 4th of July, if I'm not mistaken, they would play it. I remember at least one watching it. Yeah, I mean, there's something like uniquely gritty and dark and compelling about a war where the people there, often the characters in these movies, don't believe in the war. They're just they're fighting kind of against their will in
right,
a way.
Yeah,
you hadn't really seen before that. You know, not the same with World War II. There's potential there with World War I, but that didn't really make it into the pop culture. But McCain returns to the U.S. In 1973, he's tortured, and his story does change at various points at what information he gave up or didn't give up. But 1973, he comes back, and as we said, yeah, he kind of missed the culture war. Nixon's been reelected. He gets obsessed with trying to figure out how they could have done this war better. Because it's kind of starting to wind down at that point, correctly? Nixon's next term.
Yeah, 73. It's when the peace treaty is signed. It's effectively over in 73, although violence continues until the final moments in April 75. That's April 75 is when those like pictures of the helicopters lifting off, mm-hmm. and people are like, that's the last moment of American military presence in Vietnam. Yeah.
Right.
Before any of us were born, I think.
Yes.
Or close to that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
but we're sitting here talking about it. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Is like, to me, I'm fascinated by how that like is embedded in like the generation of older people that we're around.
Yeah.
That it's just kind of like, well, that's their story, but it's kind of our story too. We're stuck with it.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, without getting into too many details, my uncle served in Vietnam and it had a really significant impact on my family and my mother. And he did end up joining Veterans Against the War. Mm. But there's this dynamic that's kind of possibly retconned about soldiers coming home, being spat on, called baby killer. Did that kind of get exaggerated? Was there any truth to that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole book about that by Jerry Lemke, who's a sociologist, who wrote about the whole concept of like urban legends and urban myths and how they spread around. And yeah, I think it was called the spitting image or something like that. But yeah, he sort of took that apart as mythology. And you know, maybe it did happen. I don't know. But yeah, the idea that there is an idea that American veterans from Vietnam came home, and the story often goes is like they were at the airport, and as soon as they got off the plane, which didn't happen because they didn't come home that way, they didn't but either way, the image is like there was some like hippie, often a woman, who like spit and said they was baby killer. You see it in Forrest Gump, actually. They like do the baby killer thing, but they show, yeah, it's the left, it's like a leftist that yells at Forrest. who brought the baby killer. But yeah, I think it's played out in a really unfortunate way, because it exaggerates this thing that probably never happened. I brought up this book in class. So I've been teaching college classes on Vietnam in my life at some point. And God, many students have challenged me and said, no, that happened. It happened to my uncle, usually an uncle or a friend or a neighbor. No, that happened. They told me directly. And so, you know, I mean, how easy is it to just tell them that they're lying to their face, you know, something like that. I don't know. It's not really a conversation I want to have, but I think it's interesting that it persists, because it's also in Rambo, at the end of Rambo, which is again, another one of these 80s movies that like sort of made me think, what the fuck is going on with this generation of older people? Because Rambo at the end of that movie, he's like, you know, we fought for this country and we came home and they spit on us. I think it's in part, I kind of identify or understand that American veterans in Vietnam did feel like shit when they came home, because nobody wanted to talk about what they'd gone through. There was no ticker tape parade. It was not like World War II, where they were just going to be celebrated for the rest of their life. It was instead a feeling of like, who cares about Vietnam, or let's not talk about it. And I think that would be extraordinarily painful for someone who had gone to war, sacrificed something, and come back to a country that they felt didn't really honor that or care about it, or even was antagonistic towards it. So that might contribute to some of that, I don't know, legend.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I think, speaks to McCain as a peculiar figure in that he does, I think that really hardens him, the reaction, the fight, the domestic spats over Vietnam, but he doesn't go full tilt reactionary. I mean, of course, he ends up enabling that, but he doesn't go, you know, he's not a hard right conservative, I guess, when he comes back. And I think for a time, it's not even clear, because he wants to go into politics and he doesn't even know what party he's going to join. But he ends up in Arizona and tries to and succeeds in becoming basically the successor to Barry Goldwater. And to do that, of course, you have to be a Republican. Cheats on his wife, one of his first marriage.
And I was going to say, why is he in Arizona?
Yep, there's a nice young woman named Cindy who he meets. I believe they meet in Hawaii, and his other wife, Carol, has been injured in a car accident, and he kind of, you know, dumps her, and marries a beer heiress, and that helps launch his political career. How bipartisan is that phenomenon at this point in the 70s, 80s, all these Vietnam vets going into political office?
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't looked at that stuff for a long time. I was just reading about the phenomenon of World War II veterans coming back and taking political office. And there, a lot of them were like coming back to the common thread among the veterans who run for office is often like, not just that I served in the military or I'm a decorated war hero, but that I have some special talent for maybe administering things and maybe being pure and true to what America is really about. So it, in a very, very broad way, the veteran has a sort of automatic power to speak to American values because they fought for them or they bled for them. And you know, in terms of Vietnam, I think that's a really tricky thing. And I think it gets less tricky as time goes on. Like in the 1970s, you're going to have Vietnam veterans who are going to be running for government. And they're going to, you know, they're going to have different takes on the Vietnam War, and that's really going to define their politics. I think later on, when McCain is an older guy and it's the 2000s, a lot of the specifics of those politics have gone away, and it's just the service that's left. So if anything, I would say that the Vietnam War is going to hang over American politics in a very specific way in the 70s and 80s, and that's going to impact the way veterans are running. But that gets less so as time goes on, and it just becomes another war that people fought in. I feel like I don't know. I mean, with the exception of Jane Fonda, I'm wondering like who is still suffering as a result of their take on Vietnam, right? Because it's like McCain, he's sort of unimpeachable because of it in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Right. And even she was, you know, able to launch continue a successful movie career and launch an exercise tape empire.
Oh yeah. I mean, she survived. She's still on like Netflix shows and stuff like that. But what's crazy is I still follow her around, you know, on social media and stuff, in part because I wrote about her in the book. She was a big part of the coffee house movement that I wrote about. But either way, she's someone who, you know, anything on social media where she comes up, even if it's just like an ad for like a TV show she's on, there's tons of comments underneath that are just like insanely vicious about Hanoi Jane and her being a traitor and she should be executed and all this crazy shit. She is like the Joan of Arc for the right wing. And really, in a lot of ways, I think she maintains a power because she, for whatever reason, is linked to the people that are still talking about Vietnam and that are still pissed about it from, you know, 60 years later.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that period where the Vietnam is slowly becoming kind of sanitized. I feel like maybe the last like hot button issue is POWMIA, which seems to be kind of crossed some wires in terms of partisanship in America. But McCain and John Kerry, who are both veterans, go over to Vietnam. They investigate it, they check it out, and they come back. They're like, sorry, nobody's there. Activists are just not willing to accept that. And there's a crazy moment where McCain is like accosted by some POWMIA people, and one of them is in a wheelchair and he's like screaming at them, and he just like wheels the woman away who's yelling at him about this.
Jesus. Yeah. I mean, it's funny bring up John Kerry, because I mean, John Kerry, George W. Bush, and John McCain, that those figures, all Vietnam, like really defined them in a lot of ways. And they talked about it a lot in their presidential campaigns. And I mean, John Kerry famously got Swift boated. They were they made him look like, there were dudes that came out and said that he wasn't as injured as he said. And it's kind of amazing. Cause like, we're sitting here saying, well, oh, you can get hurt in Vietnam and that's just going to be always unimpeachable, but not necessarily, because John Kerry got really like kind of hurt badly politically by people who, I don't know if they made it up or whatever, they attacked his service and it stuck. And it helped George W. Bush. I think that's what the politics of that was. I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I feel like it was. I mean, Karl Rove's strategy is always to attack the strength of his opponent.
Right.
So
yes,
that was like the thing Kerry could. That's what got him the nomination. Is
Rove, God, a huge figure. Forgotten in some ways, I feel like. But I'm glad you brought him up. God.
Yeah, I mean, he would, of course, deny that he had anything to do with it. But that was very effective, because that was the thing Kerry was talking about, and what, you know, Iraq war is a very live issue. And we have a veteran we're going to run. Wouldn't you know it? There's some people questioning his credibility as to him being a war hero. But there's another thing that Karl Rove, I mean, this is interesting, because I can, you know, a long time ago, I just figured it was absolutely Karl Rove in the 2000 primaries with Bush and McCain. And there's these rumors that come out that he's got an illegitimate black daughter and all this really nasty stuff in the South Carolina primary. But at the time, I can kind of see South Carolina 2000. You have McCain, who's very wishy-washy on abortion and a lot of other social issues, running almost like a social liberal, who South Carolina, heavily evangelical state. I could see other factions there wanting Bush and perhaps doing it. Perhaps it wasn't Karl Rove who stirred the pot on that. I don't know. I mean, wouldn't put it past him for sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, McCain was sort of like being the Republican that was like, I don't hate gay people, basically. Yeah. Right. Like that was his take. So much of me is like, was that just like a conscience thing with him? Was it a strategy? Like why did he take these moderate positions and try to sort of separate himself from the Republican Party. And I say that because at some point, isn't it in 2000 when he's running for president, someone asked him why he's running? He's like, well, I'm not running for any policy reason or to achieve anything. I'm running because I personally want to achieve being president. Like, it's just like, I just want to be president. It's almost like a Trump thing. Like, there's a kind of like, I don't know, there's almost a refreshing admission that I want the prize. And so that's why I'm sitting here being like, why the moderate takes? Is that just strategy or what's he doing? Because it does expose him to the Rove just assassinating him with this really dirty type of tactics in South Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it could be part of his political grooming in Arizona. Specifically, you have Barry Goldwater, who is, you know, very, very right wing on a lot of issues, but on social issues in particular, is really not on the same wavelength as the religious right. And I think McCain maybe is kind of going from his playbook, and maybe genuinely was a little more not as eager to demonize gay people or women getting abortions. But he certainly changes his tune by 2008, although you can always tell he's kind of clenching his teeth and doesn't really want to do it. But what in 2000, though, it's interesting in retrospect, the real issue that he's running on is his main platform is campaign finance reform.
Right.
Which is, again, very bizarre in retrospect, but he wants to limit the amount of money a person can donate, which, you know, not as far as public financing, but that would really upend the political system in America.
It makes him seem like he came from Occupy Wall Street or something, honestly, when you hear that, right? Because I'm like, wasn't Occupy Wall Street, the whole point of that movement was, I mean, there were a lot of fingers to that movement, but a lot of the base of it was like, we have to take the influence of money out of politics. And that might sound naive, that might sound like the right thing to do, but it seems like McCain was tapping into that before Occupy, interestingly.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of it comes from the Keating Five in the 1980s. He gets in hot water for a savings and loan scandal. And then after that, he becomes Mr. Ethics. That's when he gets more crafts the Maverick reputation and is very successful at doing that because he's able to pitch himself as just a moral actor. And he's accused by colleagues of being kind of Manichaean. Other senators think he's too dogmatic about certain things and judgmental of other senators for not having his ethics or professed ethics. And then by 2000, that's like a live issue in that campaign because, you know, Cold War is over. There's kind of humdrum domestic politics. We're arguing about, you know, how much to cut taxes, what to do with the surplus. Very tedious,
boring
stuff. This is
all pre-9/11, right?
Yeah.
I'm sitting here being like, I wasn't really that active in politics or thought about it before 2000. I'm like, well, why? Part of it was because I was young and didn't care. But other part of it was 9/11 hadn't really drilled into our minds yet as the new reality.
Right.
It's just campaign finance reform is what we were talking about. I mean, when you're 17, you don't care about that.
What was your, did you vote in the 2000 election?
I think, I didn't vote. And when I think about it now, I was literally like doing a Jack Kerouac on the road, post-college road trip.
Nice.
And I didn't vote. I don't think I registered to vote. I don't think and it's weird because this is like my political awareness in a lot of ways was driving across the country. I'd never done this before. I drove from California to Chicago and Tennessee and then North Carolina. And so I saw everything. And we even went to Washington, D.C. And I was in Washington, D.C. on the night that the 2000 election happened. It didn't get decided that night because it eventually went to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
But I remember I went to the White House a couple days before and I pet Buddy, the White House dog. And it was like kind of the waning days of the Clinton administration. I was interested in politics and I was aware that something was happening. But what I remember the most is I was shocked by how many people supported Bush throughout the country. Like as we were driving across the country, me and my college buddy were noticing like, holy shit, there are a lot of like Bush signs like everywhere. And we're from Southern California. So we're sitting here You don't see that many of that much of that there. Maybe not the dominant thing, but either way, the kind of like this is Bush country thing was impressed upon me. And you know, after it went to the Supreme Court, and that became a bigger moment than we thought with the kind of stolen election of the Supreme Court and all that. That was, I mean, I think that was of the beginnings of my political awareness. That's a long way of saying, no, I didn't vote in that election, but that election was very, very important to me in sort of realizing that there were power structures that I didn't really pay attention to that maybe I should, and that I didn't really know the country that I live in because I come from a little slice of Southern California. Yeah.
Now that is part one of our episode on John McCain. If you want to catch part two and hear the end of my discussion with David Parsons, please go to patreon.com/thevanquished. That's patreon.com/thevanquished.